What you're about to hear is an interview with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., conducted by Mike Wallace of CBS, approximately 3 years after the I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington. Here's an excerpt of the conversation where Dr. King speaks about nonviolence and rioting. This is in 1968.
There is an increasingly vocal minority who disagreed totally with your tactics, Dr. King.
There's no doubt about that. I will agree that there is a group in the Negro community advocating violence now. I happen to feel that this group represents a numerical minority. Surveys have revealed this. The vast majority of Negroes still feel that the best way to deal with the dilemma that we face in this country is through nonviolent resistance. And I don't think this vocal group will be able to make a real dent in the Negro community in terms of swaying 22 million Negroes to this particular point of view. And I contend that the cry of black power is at bottom a reaction to the reluctance of white power to make the kind of changes necessary to make justice a reality for the Negro. I think we've got to see that a riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the economic plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years.
How many summers like this one do you imagine that we can expect?
Well, I would say this, we don't have long. The mood of the Negro community now is one of urgency, one of saying that we aren't going to wait, that we've got to have our freedom. We've waited too long. So that I would say that every summer we are going to have this kind of vigorous protest. My hope is that it will be nonviolent. I would hope that we can avoid riots because riots are self-defeating and socially destructive. I would hope that we can avoid riots, but that we will be as militant and as determined next summer and through the winter as we have been this summer. And I think the answer about how long it will take will depend on the federal government, on the city halls of our various cities, and on white America to a large extent. This is where we are at this point, and I think white America will determine how long it will be and which way we go in the future.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Barbershop Conversations on The Answer Show, and I am your gracious host, Joe Paul. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. We thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure you stay connected. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, at Joe Paul Speaks. I'd also like to invite you to join our highly controversial answers discussions that occur on Facebook, Monday through Friday, starting at noon Eastern Standard Time. Simply log on to facebook.com/Mr. Joe Paul to join the conversation. I promise we'll be waiting for you, and we'll certainly leave the light on. Joining me in the studio are two astute gentlemen, rounding out the Barbershop Conversation trio, Mr. A.J. Miller and Mr. Jackson Bracey. Gentlemen, welcome to the conversation.
What's going on, brother? Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
Definitely.
Reach out to me on social media as well. A.G.Z, the number 4, Governor, Instagram, Twitter, A.J. Miller on Facebook.
Jackson,
and you can
plug.
You can find me at thereasonablebachelor.com or on Facebook as Jackson Bracey, or at Jackson Bracey on Twitter.
Fantastic. So, gentlemen, I don't know about you guys, but I got chills just listening to the late, great Dr. King as he talked about the state of affairs just almost 50 years ago, about 47 years to be exact. And it brought chills to me because I started thinking about how 47 years have passed, and still that conversation is relevant today, right now, today. And that bugs me a little bit, you know. So I'm challenged to think, has anything really changed? I mean, individually, yes, I think things have changed for some people, but as a people, it looks like we're going backwards. Jackson, I want to start off with you, and then AJ, your reaction to Dr. King's comments.
Well, you know, and first let me say I'm glad that we're discussing this, given all the things that have happened. You know, we usually have a lighthearted kind of a tenor with Barbershop Conversation, but these are important discussions that need to be had. But speaking to your question, I would say that you know, the most telling thing is that I think that when that whole traumatic time for our country happened in the late 60s and through the martyrdom of Dr. King and Malcolm X and others, it created an atmosphere where there was a certain measure of progress, measurable, visual progress that was given to or allowed for people of color in this country. And I think it was done in a way to not equalize the playing field or level the ground for the whole entire community, but to give us enough hope to hang on to where we feel like we had arrived in such a space that in the late 70s into the 80s, you did not see the same degree of tension in our country. You know,
very true.
So as progress is made for the few, it trickles down in sentiment and emotion to the masses. And, you know, that's what we see ourselves today with the logic of a lot of people that you see on the news, white folks, people of the dominant society, where they try to contend that racism cannot be real when you have successful and millionaire athletes and entertainers and politicians. This notion that somehow by having an Oprah or a Barack Obama or a LeBron James, that they mean that you know, through process means that there is
we have
no
all
more.
Arrived.
Yeah, we have all arrived because of a few people who have been allowed to navigate or make it through the jungle that is, you know, basically our existence here in America.
Yeah, very well said, Jackson. Very well said. AGZ, I mean, I know you've thought about this, and obviously we're talking about Dr. King's comments because present day we're dealing with riots in Baltimore, 2015, and it's 50 years ago is when they were experiencing riots back then. So AJ, what's your reaction to Dr. King's comments?
Well, as that old saying goes, you know, some things change while others still remain the same. You know, Jackson said it very well, but I don't find it shocking or, you know, and or unbelievable that Dr. King's statements 47 and some odd years later are still highly applicable and relevant today, especially considering, you know, the social constructs of racism and oppression have not dramatically changed. There have been some both legislative and social changes that were somewhat meaningful, but overall, as far as their impact on the structural context of racism and oppression in America, the actual impact across the board for the totality of people of color has always been, you know, minimal at best. Like Jackson was saying, yes, it created gaps and opportunities for anomalies, but by and large, the value of, you know, black life, the social value as perceived by the predominant population or the population in power has not drastically changed. It's just become more socially unacceptable to behave in certain ways publicly. But the infrastructure that maintains all of the other bad things that go on behind the scenes that are nonverbal, that are subtle, are still alive and well. And you can see that played itself out, you know, every day in the media.
No question about it. No question about it. You know, as I sit and I watch, you know, and I don't really spend too much time in front of the idiot box, also known as the television, because I don't want to be programmed to believe any of the lies that come across the screen. And so, but you can't help but notice, you know, things burning, things breaking, people dying, people getting hurt with these riots. And I don't condone violence, but I understand. You know, I understand why they would react that way. I understand why they would go out and burn stuff up, even though it's their own stuff, which is kind of crazy and counterproductive. But they're still showing. I mean, this is really the only way that people who feel voiceless can speak. So I understand why they're out there doing that. I absolutely understand it. You know, and in that conversation, Dr. King said, you know, I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. You know what I mean? So it's not like these kids or adults or this group basically went to Baltimore and was like, man, you know, what you doing Wednesday, Charlie? Man, I ain't got nothing on the calendar, bro. Well, shoot, you want to start a riot? You know, that's not what happened. Freddie Gray died in the hands of the police. Plain and simple, that's what happened. And that's the response that people who feel like they have nothing and a history like Baltimore that's deeply rooted in racism. It's amazing. You know, West Baltimore is basically where, and you all know, that's where the HBO's hit show The Wire was taped. Did you guys watch The Wire at all, Jackson?
I never really got into The Wire. I've seen one or two episodes, but I'm not super duper familiar with it.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I don't know if that was, Jackson, you've seen it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if that was art imitating life or life imitating art, but what's your take on that show?
It was definitely pretty authentic to what my understanding of how, you know, the Baltimore city structure was for a large part of its residents, and I thought it did a masterful job of going from just, you know, going from a show that dealt with common drug trade to dealing with how the politics of the city are somehow stacked against, or in some ways stacked against, the most impoverished of the city. So, so for that portion of it, I really appreciated the show.
No question about it. And even with that, I would definitely say that it's art imitating life, because that's exactly what's going on. And West Baltimore is exactly where Gray died. And I was checking some things out about statistics based on West Baltimore, just kind of seeing where they are as a city. They have an unemployment rate of 19.1%. So 20% of the folks who live in West Baltimore don't have a job. The median household income is below $25,000, gentlemen. The median household income is below $25,000. 33% of the residents in West Baltimore are receiving food stamps. And these are stats compiled by Forbes. So, gentlemen, talk to me. I'm saying that I don't condone violence, but I understand why they would go out there and cause ruckus, as they put it. AJ, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in agreement with that. And even from a historical context, taking, you know, black or African-American culture, however you want to label it, aside, any historical context, no matter what the situation is politically, you cannot attack or make monumental change to a infrastructure, you know, trying to clean it up with the feather duster. Anytime that there has been dramatic changes in any society, it's been by force, physical force, whether you're talking about, you know, the American Revolution, Civil War, or, you know, World War II, whatever the case may be. Any monumental change made in any society has never been done, you know, on a large scale by taking a feather duster trying to clean up a dirty infrastructure. It just doesn't happen that way. But, of course, you know, when it relates to us, we have to do it the way the oppressor says, get it done.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is ultimately ineffective. So,
yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And, you know, you bring up a great point about how America has handled, has responded to situations like this, especially with the Revolutionary War. You know, they didn't go to Great Britain and say, you know, hey, it's 13 of us colonies here. You mind if we sit at the table, please? We just want our freedom. Can you hand it to us? Absolutely not. That's not how the conversation went. Right? That's not
exactly
how the conversation went at all.
Give me liberty. Give me liberty or give me death.
Or give me death. Absolutely.
That's it.
So America can't reasonably assume that people who want their liberty or their freedom can't respond the same way America did when they wanted their liberty and freedom from Great Britain. Jackson, where you at?
I think another part of that story that they forget to mention is that that big Boston Tea Party that they tore everything up and burned down, that was their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So when people say that, it comes across as, you know, I told somebody it must be nice to live in a space and in a time and a place where you never feel so frustrated or disconnected or underrepresented from the world that you live in to the point that you feel like the only way to be heard is to tear something up. Another analogy, a good friend of mine said, he said, you know, I don't know many guys who have never felt so frustrated by a scenario or situation that they haven't broken something, whether it be as a little kid in the room, whether it be on a sports team where you've put a hole in the wall or done something where the frustration welled up in you so much that you reacted. He said, 9 times out of 10, that is your stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, frustration doesn't have a, you know, frustration is probably one of the most enraging emotions that people can endure.
No question.
You know, to not only have people validate for you that you are nothing, but then to wave it in your face. And as far as then crafting a narrative that pretty much likes to focus on, you know, because all of the CNN anchors are speaking from the same script right now, which is a little, you know, which is laughable. They're all saying, like, come on, you can't really justify tearing down this stuff. Like, they're trying to get black people and black analysts to say that this is wrong without addressing the inception of what brought this on. You don't take a little girl, okay, who's been living in a house with her mother and father and an uncle who has been molesting her from the time she was 3 to the time that she was 17. Take that, I mean, just violating her from 3 to 17 right underneath her mother and father's noses, okay? You don't do that to a child, and then when the child goes to school one day and beats up a teacher or lashes out at a teacher, you don't make the focus of what she's saying, say, hey, I understand you got raped for 17 years, but you just can't go around hitting on teachers. Do you say that to them? You wouldn't dare say something like that, you know? And I think that what it really comes down to is people from the dominant society and power structure do not respect the pain and the dismay that people in the African-American community go through. They would, because it makes them feel better to ascribe our own failings as being the reason why, you know, our everything that we have or do not have is entirely as a result of us, because it feeds into this notion that they are superior only by nature and not by circumstance. Okay?
True.
So,
right.
you know, like I always say, people don't have any incentive to acknowledge that maybe I'm not better than these people. Maybe the deck and the game is kind of stacked against these people.
Yeah, and I would even correlate that with the whole black on black crime parallel, that that people that often take on a blame victim stance like to assume that it's a cultural anomaly that black people, when in fact, you know, most people that are killed by people that are the nearest to them. So odds are they're going to look alike. They're going to be from the same culture. And I think the same thing applies when you have, you know, social upheaval and social uprising. Like, you're not going to, you probably may not even have the means to travel, you know, 30, 40 miles to suburban outskirts where the oppressor lives to destroy their community. But, you know, it just doesn't make sense. You're going to act and impact where you actually physically are. And you're going to impact that area and the people in that area. It's not a cultural anomaly. So, you know, just like, you know, PWIs, when they win a big game, they tear up their school campus. They don't go to the other school that they just beat in the game and tear their campus up. They tear up their own stuff. And, you know, same thing applies for crime as well. You know, they don't drive to the hood and rob and kill black people. They rob and kill, you know, Caucasian people in their community. So, same thing.
Yeah. And let me ask you guys a question, speaking of what you just spoke to, because this, I mean, I think people need to realize this happens multiple times yearly where people of a more privileged class, of the dominant society, white folks who are of means, of wealth, are of stature. Every year, the team that loses the NCAA football game, the team that loses the NCAA basketball game, or and sometimes the teams that win those games, they tear up the campus, they tear up the local community, and it's never once have I heard a newscast or anybody in that community come out and call those children thugs. Call them thugs.
No way.
I've never heard that. Have you ever heard that?
Nope. You're not going to hear it either, because they're not the right shade. You know? You're not going to hear it. They're not the right shade. I mean, you never hear negative news. Well, you definitely do if it's egregious. But, you know, they never package it that way. You know, look at them all. They never package it as them rioting. But that's exactly what they're doing. You know, those kids, when they're tearing up signs and tearing down goalposts and bonfire in the middle of the stadium, that's exactly what they're doing. They're rioting. They're breaking stuff. They're jumping on cars. That's exactly what they're doing. Right? What is the definition of riot?
Property damage that greatly exceeds what has been done in Baltimore.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What about those kids in the fraternity, those the kids in the IFC fraternity from Michigan who went to that resort and caused, you know, $500,000 plus worth of destruction? Did you guys hear about that?
I didn't hear that story. No.
And I never heard them call those kids thugs.
No, they never did. They never did. They were misunderstood.
What it boils down to is not the actions, but the actors and what they look like, as opposed to actual behavior itself, because depending upon what you look like is going to ultimately determine how action is categorized.
And who's telling the story, right? I mean, how you look. I mean, the person who's telling the story, that's power. Yeah, exactly. The person, he who controls the message. The
messenger controls the message. You know?
Exactly right. Exactly right. No, that's absolutely right. Sticking to the same conversation, you know, we've seen stars come out, and I know Jackson, you have definitely some thoughts about this. But we've seen stars come out speaking against the protesters, causing problems in the city of Baltimore. Ray Lewis, a lot of celebrities have come out and said, hey, you know, don't do it. Carmelo Anthony came out today saying, hey, you know, stop doing it. It's really interesting that they should come out that way. I have a clip that I'm going to play in a second that kind of talks about Ray Lewis and his conversation. But Jackson, I want to start with you. What was your first take when you heard Ray Lewis's rant or motivational speech?
I can't really take Ray seriously. I like to listen to him talk about football because he gets animated, and I think it's funny, but I don't respect what Ray Lewis has to say about social issues just because I don't see him in that space, and I don't think that, you know, like, I just don't. That's not the – so I saw him, you know, these two-part videos, and I looked at it for about 30 seconds, and I turned it off because I was immediately infuriated. Ray is down there in Florida on a golf course in his mansion by the water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say that to begrudge him the opportunity to speak, because I think he cares deeply about the city of Baltimore, a city that has embraced him through his murder trial, you know, Super Bowl and the things that he's been involved in. But I will say this. It infuriates me to no end when Jada Pinkett, when old Sassy Monique, and with her down home folks, he was, oh, babies, we can't be doing this, baby. You know, come on, we got to hug these babies.
Mammy.
If you really want to talk about something, stop only wielding your voice like Stephen A. Smith does when it's okay and appropriate to criticize or to tell black people what they should do, okay? Where are you when police kill people in the street?
True.
In your city. Is it still your city then? This is my city, Ray Lewis. This is our city. Is it our city then when the police are killing people? Because if it's our city then you ought to feel comfortable enough to tell them, hey, you police got to do better. You have got to do something better. And I understand. I mean, you know, you don't want to see people tear the city down. You want to create calm. And I don't mind them saying nothing about that. I don't mind them saying, like, hey, this is not the way. I want y'all to be safe. I want things to go well. But my point is, if you run around speaking this calmness and this passion, why don't you ever tell the police to calm down?
Real talk.
When you have
true.
Several men surrounding one man who's in shackles, that is handcuffed and ankle braces, why don't you tell them to settle down?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just annoys me to no end that people that black people, and then even more so, black people of means, black people of stature, black people of influence. Why do you always tell? It's like we had this mindset that we are supposed to be subservient and deferent to deferring to an authority structure, even when the authority structure is bad. And the difference is you all don't live in this circumstance. That wasn't your friend on the street or who rides a bus with you or who is your weed man or whatever he is, okay?
True.
Because people like to throw up what this man did for a living or what his prior record was. Do we use that same type of standard to tell a woman who's been raped, well, you were kind of loose in high school? Do we allow people to say that?
True that. True that. Well said, well said, Pastor Bracey. Well said. Let us raise the offering, folks. Let us raise the offering. Yeah, no, I mean, it's real talk, though. It's really tough to – it's a tough pill to swallow, you know, when they come out, they meaning prominent black folks who are very far, far from the situation. You know, it's easy for somebody to tell you how to fix your life when their stuff is together. It's easy.
Yeah, and I find it extremely disingenuous when people like that who have been allowed some level of media access and success to come out and speak publicly to their own people in that way. Because, yes. I mean, you're owned and paid for by, you know, NFL Network or Comedy Central or whomever might be, you know, lining your pockets with whatever you deem was enough cash
for you to sell out,
forget what really goes down, and speak out publicly about it. So, you know, I take all that stuff with the grain of salt.
Real talk.
I immediately turn my head. Yeah,
I say just be fair. I mean, if you're gonna talk out about one side, talk about everything. You know, don't just keep it on telling black people what to do. Like, you've earned some sort of authority to speak on, you know, to black people. You know what I'm saying? It's like you're the granddaddy or that knows all, since you've experienced some level of success. Now you can tell people what to do. Nah, man. Direct that towards the people who are really causing the problems. Because if it wasn't for the police killing unarmed people of color, then we wouldn't need to respond in protests and riots. It just wouldn't, you wouldn't have a need to burn stuff up. You know, you absolutely wouldn't. What I want to do is I want to play something here from the Breakfast Club that talks about Ray Lewis and his comment. And you guys, you did hear the comment?
I didn't know, not yet.
Okay. And what about you, Jackson?
Sorry, I heard excerpts and listened to a little bit of his interview. So I just heard him encouraging people to not be involved in this, and we're better than this, and this is our city, and all that type of stuff.
Okay, so here's the Breakfast Club, and they had a little something to say, something in line with kind of what we had that we just talked about. Here's a clip from them.
Yes, Donkey of the Day for Wednesday, April 29th goes to good brother Ray Lewis, formerly of the Baltimore Ravens. I guess he's always a Baltimore Raven, all right? Yeah. I think Ray Lewis is a great motivational speaker, but Ray Lewis has to learn to either change his rhetoric or just not acknowledge certain things, okay? Now, I fully expected, you know, a guy like Ray Lewis to speak out on what's going on in Baltimore. I mean, Ray Lewis is Baltimore. He's a Baltimore legend, you know, 2 Super Bowls with the Ravens. So, of course, he has the right to speak his mind and tell the community to chill out. All I'm saying, though, if you have been accused of double murder in your life and you never took responsibility for either one of the murders, even though the white suit he was wearing had blood on it, and that suit was never recovered. Ray Lewis also admitted that he gave a misleading statement to Baltimore police on the morning of the killings by lying and saying he was never at the scene. Not to mention, the blood of one of the guys killed was found in Ray Lewis's limo. Clearly, Ray Lewis had something to do or knows something about the murders, but hey, it doesn't matter. He came out clean in court, went on to have a great NFL career, and you would think, since he has never taken any responsibility for what happened the night those guys were killed, you would think he would try to say things that don't keep causing people like myself to keep bringing his past mistakes up, okay? Well, Ray Lewis did this video yesterday talking to the people of Baltimore, and he was striving to deliver a great message, and it would have been a great message if not for a couple of things. Let's hear it.
Young kids, you got to understand something. Get off the street. Violence is not the answer. Violence has never been the answer. Freddie Gray, we don't do nothing for him doing this. Baltimore, get off the street. Kids, go home. Stay home. We know we're not getting the right justice. We know all these answers. But rising in our streets is wrong. It's dead wrong. And the sad part is, we got young kids trying to tell us how they're going to dictate our city. That won't happen.
Okay. Violence is not the answer. He also said it.
Why
you
sound like Randy Savage, though?
Violence is never the answer. Well, did you feel like that on January 31st, 2000, when the fight broke out between you and your partners, Ray Lewis? You said it has never been the answer. Well, the two people who were stabbed to death on January 31st, 2000, wish you had adopted that mentality 15 years ago, good brother. Stop the violence, you said. You should have screamed that the night those guys were stabbed, OG. You have the right to speak out, but just tell the community of Baltimore to stop the rioting. Okay, every word means something, and your choice of words is very poor. Tell the kids, stop the rioting, stop burning down your own community, stop looting. But I don't want to hear about the stoppage of violence from you, Ray Lewis. I just don't think that message will be received well. That's like Floyd Mayweather telling people you shouldn't hit girls. Kim Kardashian telling you you should be more private. Okay? Look, Ray Lewis, I respect what you attempted to do. You gave it the old college try. You took a stab at it, but no. No. Give Ray Lewis the biggest hee-haw, please.
So, gentlemen, I mean, do people who have been, like, Ray Lewis's situation, I mean, do you still have a voice? I mean, do you have a right to express how you feel publicly? If you have, if you're a public figure, even though, like, for instance, just like he was saying, those examples, I mean, does Kim Kardashian have the right to come out and tell somebody about being private and kind of not having sex and all that stuff? I mean, does she have that right? Even though she...
I think they do, Joe. If they can be upfront, be reflective, and acknowledge that the things that they've been involved in the past were not right. And I think that's what I think they were kind of getting to. I'm not above taking advice on somebody who has made a mistake that they see me about to make if they can acknowledge that it was a mistake. You understand
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's the people who go out there and, you know, they whoremonger around and they do these types of things and then try to talk to you about the, you know, how much you need to get your stuff together and get married and things like that. Those who, and they never acknowledge that they lost something from what they were doing, you know. Mm-hmm. I just think that's the problem, you know. You know, people like Ray, you know, have never acknowledged that, like, what I was involved in at that time was wrong, you know, but I don't have a problem taking, you know, crude direction from people who've been through something and they're just trying to show you a way to steer around what they did.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think his words had any less of an impact. I just think that he should have had the same kind of video for when Freddie Gray died or when Tamir Rice died or when Eric Garner died or when Mike Brown died or when, I mean, I can go down how many more do I need to go? You know, I mean,
the Rudd girl in Chicago, or how about the woman in Fairfax County, Virginia, who was tased to death, the schizophrenic woman who was tased to death in shackles.
Mm-hmm. How about the brother who had mental illness, who was walking out of his home, and his mother called the police ahead of time and told them that her son suffered from mental illness, and they still shot and killed that man dead, and he had a screwdriver in his hand because presumably he was afraid. I mean, he see police right in his door, what is his face? But I mean, we can talk about how many of these things happen over and over and over again. You know, I really want to talk about, like, what needs to happen, you know, with West Baltimore alone. And we've had the same conversation with Ferguson, same conversation with all these other places that this injustice continues to occur. But since 2011, 100 people have received nearly $6 million in settlements for cases of alleged excessive force, right? 100 people, $6 million. Now, here's something that you have to understand. These things happen so frequent. This is what this next stat tells me, okay? these things happen so frequent that a law had to be put in place to limit how much you can actually receive in damages. So $200,000 is the limit mandated by Maryland law for claims against local governments, including police departments. $200,000. So it doesn't matter what they do. They can kill you.
Not only can the state and the city government kill you, but they can put a cap on how much damages you can receive as a result of their negligence. That is not a criminal act in itself.
Yeah.
That's as criminal as telling people, which the government will do, when it tells people that you don't have a right to appeal a charge or a case against you that doesn't go your way. That you should never be handcuffed with such an opportunity.
No, I totally agree.
Especially
if it's
a paltry sum.
Real talk. And $200,000, I'm like, so they're saying that's basically how much your life is worth, $200,000. You know, well, actually, they're saying it's worth less than that, but the max that you can get is $200,000. You know, what's your take on it, AJ?
Yeah, that's totally unbelievable and unethical. But again, I mean, you know, what do you expect? This is a pattern that's been ongoing for numerous years, and rather than address the issue, rather than address the symptom, they're, you know, putting parameters and rules in place to protect the corruption, which is ridiculous.
Protect the thugs. The state employed, county certified, badge wearing thugs.
True that. Man. That's exactly what it is. And speaking of badge-wearing thugs, did a little research on Baltimore Police Department and kind of its history and how it was founded, and even tried to figure out who the first African-American officers were. Just really wanted to know the makeup. And so as a historically Irish-American dominated police department, the first African-American was hired in 1937. Okay, in 1937. And they were plainclothes officers. They didn't even get uniforms. Uniforms came in 1943. African-American officers were finally allowed to wear police uniforms. This is interesting to me. I'm trying to figure out if these officers just need cultural and racial sensitivity training, right? And then I started thinking, well, okay, you can give them cultural and racial sensitivity training, but will that work? Because you've given them other training that supposedly is supposed to keep them from killing unarmed citizens of the United States, right? But they don't follow that training every time they interact with people of color. So will cultural or racial sensitivity training work? I don't know. AJ, I'll start with you, Jackson. You round up the circle. So AJ, I propose one of the propositions I make is the current officers have to go through cultural and racial sensitivity training before they get back on the streets, or if they're policing a particular neighborhood. Is that an effective response to all the police brutality that we're seeing? Will that make a dent? Will that make a difference?
Perhaps in officers who have good intentions, but I mean, just as in the general population, I think that any police force is going to be reflective of, you know, the type of people that are actually in the community. So that equals both good and bad people. I saw a post on someone's Facebook page today where they were talking to this gentleman on, I believe it was CNN or one of those cable news networks, and this particular black guy was talking about his interaction with former Klansmen and how he often those people would gift him with, you know, robes and hoods and stuff like that, that they no longer had any use for. But this particular one that he had a uniform that belonged to a Grand Dragon in the Ku Klux Klan. And then he said that he not only gave him the Grand Dragon hood and robe, but underneath that, he had his City of Baltimore police uniform. So I say that to say that, you know, you can have cultural and sensitivity training all you want to, but the training is only going to be as good as the person in the uniform. So if your intent is ill from the beginning, you know, I can tell you and teach you everything about how to handle people in the community. But if you are already conditioned and believe the complete opposite, then, you know, no amount of training is going to correct that. I think it would be more important on the front end to weed out those type of bad seeds through, you know, psychological testing and thorough character and background checks.
True. And, you know, one of the things that, Jackson, I wanted to definitely get your take on it. One of the things I definitely have to point out is that police are, first of all, they're armed, right? Not only are they armed with deadly weapons, but they're trained to kill, right? That's what they're trained to do. Would you guys agree?
Absolutely.
Right? They're trained to kill. That's a training that they get. They're trained to kill. They know which points to shoot at. They know on your body, and they train over and over and over to cause instant death. Jackson, will giving them training, will that make a dent in how they interact with communities of color?
No.
What's your take?
It won't. That's just a pacifying mechanism that you put in place to kind of appease black folks. But they've done that before. We're going to have cultural sensitivity, and we're going to have this awareness thing. The real problem, as I see it, is policies that are put in place to make police officers above any level of authority or or accountability. Okay, so they train them, like you said, they train them to shoot first in protection of their life at all costs. Okay, so so when you give people that much autonomy in this position of authority, where they're walking around carrying guns, there's really literally not a whole. There's almost you really have to go a long, long way to undermine what is called "quote unquote" police procedure. That is used to kill people. We've had people being shot in public, in front of large groups, on camera, all these things before. This is not new, but there's always a spokesperson that comes out right away and says, viewing what we have seen, we believe the author, Officer Jones, has followed the proper police procedure and policy. When they say that, they're letting you know that there's already a justification that we have on deck to go to save this man. And it always comes back to the number one rule that says that I was in fear for my life.
This man
in Chicago who just shot that black girl, he shot her in an alleyway. He was in his car shooting over his shoulder. What part of the game or police procedure is that? I'll tell you what it was. He ultimately got off because he convinced people that he was afraid when this child pulled out a cell phone because he thought it was a gun. So as long as you have a policy in place that is directed around teaching police officers that under any circumstance that their personal safety is the most important thing, then you're going to always lose. The guy in Baltimore said it the other night. He said, our number one priority on the street is police safety. That's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
He said that right before he introduced the mayor, at which point she started calling people thugs.
True.
Not only that, I don't think that Asian, Black, or Latino officers could get away with some of the things that Caucasian
officers
get away with. You couple privilege with that type of, you know, power and authority in the position of a police officer, you get these type of scenarios, because ultimately at the end of the day, when you couple that white privilege with a scenario where there's somebody of color involved that has been victimized and unjustly killed, it's not the victim, the dead body or the dead person that's going to get the benefit of the doubt. It's going to be that white officer in a position of privilege and authority that's going to get the benefit of the doubt, because there's no way that, you know, this pure white Christian police officer could not have been in fear of his life when the Black Beast was on the loose. I mean, what did you think was going to happen? He had to do it.
You know, you bring up a good point there, AJ, because when they were describing how Dan Wilson saw Mike Brown, he mentioned that he saw like a superhuman, like a beast, like a demon, I think is what the words that he actually used. So they already see us. I mean, they already view us, and not only them, but everybody else who controls the message of what they want people to see. Because truth be told, what's going on in Baltimore is a little different than what you see on the news. A lot of that fire and all that stuff is, according to, you know, some colleagues who actually live in Baltimore and drive into D.C., they're telling me, well, no, a lot of it is actually in one concentrated area, but a lot of the other areas are okay. But, you know, the media will have you believe something completely different. So, Jackson, you were going to say something on that?
No, just that, you know, you're absolutely right. Anytime you can allow people to justify a characterization that you see somebody as a beast or a demon or superhuman, then guess what? You are automatically disqualified from holding this job, holding this position, okay? Because it's already showing that you're a scary person. You don't have the same level of rationale to be able to handle the rigor of this job.
True. Very true. Very true. Okay, so training won't work. We've established that. Now, what about this? Okay, I got two more answers, if you will, for the response here. How about this? What if we had more Black police officers, Jackson? What if we just got more Black police officers patrolling the streets and patrolling the communities that and living in the communities that they serve? I had a conversation with a colleague of mine, and he said, "Well, Joe, come on." He's like, you know, these officers don't live in the hood. I mean, you can't expect them to live in the hood and police the hood.
In Baltimore, a lot of them live in Pennsylvania. In Baltimore County, a lot of them live in York, Pennsylvania. They come from, you know, pl- places outside of the area to get their jollies off patrolling the rough, tough, and dangerous. It's like a game, man. It's like a game of crabs in a barrel for people.
Wow. That's absolutely
but
sad.
But to answer your question, the only way I would agree that that is appropriate and that that will make a dent is if it's done in unison with changing policies that absolve police officers from any wrongdoing. I do think that it helps to have people who look like you and who have a certain ingrained appreciation for you. But I will say this. It is very easy when you bring in a dozen police officers into a dozen black police officers into a police force that is like entirely white. It is very easy for those people to be homogenized and mainstream into that same level of sentiment, to where even those black officers will start to view these people and be conditioned to believe that they're animals.
No question about it. No question about it. And, you know, I've seen examples where that brotherhood between police officers is stronger. It doesn't even cross color lines. You know, a black officer will bond closer to a white officer than he will to a black civilian. I've seen that many, many times. AJ, what were you going to say?
Not only what you guys were both saying is correct and accurate, but that's a good message. But the fundamental purpose of these police departments is really not community policing and developing relations within the community to where there is a high level of trust, understanding, and commitment to actually better the living environment for everybody involved. The actual fundamental purpose and agenda of these police officers are to feed the prison system. So it's not a counselor to a counselee type relationship, or a mentor to a mentee type relationship, or a let's work together to build a safer community. It's, you know, we have large funders and political figures that have large financial ties and investments in, you know, private prison systems. So we need military force to, you know, rope and wrangle these people so we can, you know, keep these cells full and keep revenue flowing in a direction that it needs to flow. That's the agenda. So
while exterminating the race, there
are no rules in regard for life along the way. You know,
if,
let's get them. Let's herd them into the prison system. And you know, if anybody
at a particular
gets in their
age,
way, you know, you were in fear for your life, so you had to do what you had to do. They're dangerous.
Yeah,
dangerous people.
And absolutely. The hunting begins at an early age for these folks, you know, when they start looking for it. Look at Tamir Rice, 12 years old. 12 years old. I mean, they didn't even give the little dude a chance. They just assumed that this animal, this 12-year-old animal, you know, because by 12, black people are really 35 years old, you know, in society's eyes, right? Because otherwise they wouldn't throw the book at us as much as they did.
To hear them on the radio call refer to him as a 20-something black male and overinflate his height and weight
was alarming.
It was alarming. He was just in grave shock.
It's confusing. It's confusing. So as we wrap up the show, I have one more answer. Okay, so adding more black police officers may help. It may help. It really depends. I think obviously a lot more thought would need to go into a plan like that. But what about this one? What about this one? What about segregation, right? Complete segregation between races. Blacks will have their own banks, their own hospitals, their own schools, their own communities, their own stores. They'll have their own section of the community, while whites have their own stores, their own hospitals, own thing. And blacks will be policed by blacks. The banks will be owned by blacks. Hospitals, I mean, we have enough bread to spread that around. So what about that? What about that, AJ? And then Jackson, I'll let you round us out. What about that? What about can segregation help us?
Oddly enough, as funny as it may sound, even though separate but equal was struck down quite some time ago, people of privilege and financial means still have the opportunity and capability to segregate themselves within the confines of the law because of their financial means. So what does that look like? So because I'm extremely successful, I can isolate myself with people that pretty much by and large look like me, except for a few anomalies. You know, Michael Jordan might live in my neighborhood. Okay, I'm okay with that because he's not, you know, necessarily a quote-unquote regular, you know, black guy. But by and large, if you're extremely successful or if you are of means, you can still pretty much live a segregated lifestyle. So you can interact with people of color or whatever type of people that you want to interact with, you know, at your pleasure. So, you know, if it comes a point in time where you're not feeling that this week or whatever, you can, you know, drive safely back to your gated community where only, you know, Michael Jordan and Chris Rock live. But people,
which is kind of what's happening now anyway.
People that, you know, aren't as privileged do not have that luxury. But what do I think about that? I think that, you know, I think it's good to have diversity, of course, in every community, but I think there are extreme benefits to having that luxury. I mean, look at the people in privilege that do have that luxury. Although you probably wouldn't find anybody that, you know, would speak candidly about it, but I think there are benefits to being able to isolate yourself within your own community, especially if it's a positive and safe environment.
Of course. And it's a network. I mean, it's a network. There's, you know, they teach you the unwritten rules of the game, if you will. You know, it's a network of folks that, you know, you can count on. You know, Jim is the doctor and, you know, Al is the attorney and, you know, Wilson is the accountant. I mean, you know all that. And back in the day, they had Black Wall Street. They had black doctors. People took pride in that. And there was nothing for a doctor to live next to a janitor who lived next to an educator. It was nothing because everybody kind of took care of the community, and they had a sense of community. When you take all of that out of a community, right? And to me, I think a community consists of, you know, banks, hospitals, schools, self-sustaining stores, you know, that kind of thing. And when you start taking banks out of the Black community, then you start taking hospitals out, then you start taking schools out, then you start taking stores out, then you start putting in just churches and Chinese restaurants. And, you know, what are you doing? That's not a community. You know, that's definitely not a community. So, Jackson, I want to ask you, can segregation help or hurt the situation here? Go ahead.
I don't think that I do. Well, first of all, I don't believe in the myth of 100% integration and expecting people to view people who are different from them with the same level of compassion and empathy and love and adoration as they do people who look just like them. I think that's unrealistic. I think it's a failed sort of experiment. And I think that in large part, it really speaks to just the self-hate that Black people have, that we're always desirous of an opportunity to move next to, send out those kids to school with, do business with, people who do not look like us before we do business with our own. We're the only ones who really pretty much practice that sort of ideology. Now, that doesn't mean that I believe that, you know, all the Black people should move to Nevada, and all, you know, 30 million of us should inhabit Nevada, New Mexico, and Arizona. I think that it would be a bad idea strategically for Black people to all be in one place at the same time.
Well, it ain't close to water. It ain't close to water, so we might be good.
But even if we had California as beachfront property, or South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, I just don't think that that's smart strategically, given that we live in a space and in a place where, you know, people are not always favorable to you, and that the government in past times has, you know, colluded with people to do away with you and, you know, plot for your destruction to a certain degree. So while I do believe that it is important for Black folks to be self-sustaining, meaning emphasizing what you said about Black communities with banks, stores, education, services, and things like that, so you never have to rely on somebody else's expertise to take care of you, to create an entirely separate existence in America, I think would be bad for us. You know, I think it'd be bad. I would prefer the idea that we all up and move to Africa before we all, you know, created one inclusion in enclosed community as the 33 million Black people in America. I think that's bad strategy because you can't live here and do away with the sentiment that a lot of Black people who hate Black people already have for themselves, and, you know, you don't always have a Don Lemon in the group, you know. So
true.
You can't function like that when you got, you know, a bunch of Don Lemons right here in the camp who are right there next to the people who have at times effectively been your mortal enemy.
Very true. Very well said, Jackson. Very well said. Now, we covered a lot on this episode of Barbershop Conversation. I wanted to finish with a quote from Mr. Rogers. You all know Mr. Fred Rogers. And I want to challenge people who are listening to the sound of our voices to truly stand up and be heard. This fight is not going we can't win this fight alone. And by alone, I mean just one group. I mean, it really is going to take people who are used to sitting on the sidelines to stand up for and be heard. So this is a quote from Fred Rogers that really sums up what we expect everyone to say. We live in a world in which we need to share responsibility. It's easy to say it's not my child, or it's not my community, or it's not my world, it's not my problem. Then there are those who see the need and respond. I consider those people my heroes. Well, folks, we definitely need a few more heroes out there. I'm Joe Paul. And I hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Barbershop Conversation. On behalf of AJ Miller, Jackson Bracey, and the rest of the crew here, this is The Answer Show. And I want to thank you for tuning in. Be sure to check out all of our shows. They're available to listen and download at www.joepaulspeaks.com. And remember, if you've got questions, we've got answers. Peace.
The answer.